I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Kimberly Ray Miller didn't know the word hoarding until she was a senior in high school, even though her father was a longtime hoarder. The houses they lived in were filled with old furniture and boxes, papers, and trash that became breeding grounds for fleas and rats. There was so much stuff they couldn't open doors or use the kitchen. They didn't even know that someone had been secretly living in their attic. But from the outside, they looked like everyone else's family. But Kimberly didn't invite friends over and made sure if another parent drove her home, they dropped her off at someone else's house. She was ashamed of how she lived and kept it a secret. She's now gone public and written a memoir titled Coming Clean. She says she wants to humanize hoarders like her father and give children of hoarders a voice. And Kimberly Ray Miller, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you also want to correct some of these reality shows that have been shown on TV about hoarders?
Well, you know, I'm grateful for those shows in one sense because they've brought attention to this illness that has been for so long in the shadows. And with awareness comes treatment and comes more professionals trained in this area, as well as more dialogue from people who did live through it. But I also worry that we get an unfair perspective of what life is like for a hoarder. These are people who apply to be on a TV show. They need help, and they're desperate for help. And we see them really in a very stressful situation, sort of living out their worst nightmare, and we're watching it on television. So,
well, I have to say, I for a time had watched some of those shows just because I was so both intrigued and bothered, upset, and always identified with the children. I always, because you saw children trying to sort of hold their family together, both frustrated with their parents, but clearly loving their parents.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard situation for children, and I think it forces a lot of them to grow up far too soon and take on parental roles.
This is a hard book to write.
It was absolutely. It was really heartbreaking for everyone, for me, for my parents. You know, we all had to relive it, and that was, it was freeing in a lot of ways, too.
Is that in part why you wanted to write the book? I mean, to both tell us about children of hoarders, but also to help free yourself, perhaps?
Yeah. You know, I say in the book that I didn't forget. I just simply decided not to remember. For many years, I just put the images of my childhood away. And in writing this book, I really had to come to terms with the fact that all of this really did happen. And I did have feelings towards it. I was angry at the way I was raised. But being angry didn't mean that there wasn't room for love in my family, and I couldn't accept my parents for having a mental illness, but also doing the best they could in everything else.
Now, your dad really was a hoarder.
Yes, absolutely.
Hoarded papers, stuff.
Right. I mean, it started with papers and radios, and then over the years sort of grew into anything, things that were broken, things that were cheap, things that he could find some sort of meaning in and use for.
And meaning because at some point he thought, maybe I might need this, I might want to use it. I remember this from my childhood, something like that.
Absolutely, but also things that he connected with that were reminders of me or of my mother or of someone he once knew that brought comfort to him. And so I think there's a huge emotional aspect for a lot of people in what they collect.
And how about your mom?
I separate my mom as a compulsive shopper because the pathology is different. My mom shops out of boredom, and it does get out of hand at times, but she also doesn't have the same emotional connection to things. We can throw out the stuff as soon as it comes in. It's not an emotional aspect for her. So it certainly enabled my father. It certainly added to the mess, but I do believe there's a difference between compulsive shopping and hoarding.
But the idea is that she would shop, I guess, online.
Yeah.
Packages would arrive, but she might never wear the clothes, for instance.
Well, for a good portion of my childhood, my mother was bedridden from disability, and after the disability healed, she was still so depressed because of the failed surgeries and the way her body was later formed that the depression almost became stifling for her. And so she was just stuck at home in the mess, and the depression-fueled shopping just added to the environment.
Describe your home for us.
It changed over the course of my lifetime. You know, my house was always full. I don't remember it ever being empty, but the childhood of my home of my childhood was clean hoarding. It was, there was papers and stuff everywhere, but I wouldn't necessarily say it was filthy. The house that I lived in when I left for college was absolute squalor. Over the years, our pipes had burst, and so we had this constant dripping that created an almost paper mache like floor to our home that was squishing beneath our feet, and the ceilings crumbled. There was mold, rats, fleas. Our toilets no longer worked. We ended up joining a gym so we could shower once a week. We had no heat in the wintertime. It really was a condition you would never expect someone in a normal suburban community to live in.
And from the outside, what did it look like?
It definitely looked like a rundown house. I wouldn't say that my parents kept up a good front for the neighborhood. Sorry. But you wouldn't expect it to be like that inside. It was sort of a beaten-up old house with maybe a little bit too much garbage on the side and overgrown shrubbery.
And I guess over time, and I know that your dad, he drove a bus for a while. I mean, mm-hmm. he was able to be employed for a while.
Yeah.
Got hit in the head, and it sounded like that was at least a beginning of a decline for him.
Yes. He, at one point, was in an accident at work where part of the bus he was driving fell off the bus and hit him on the head, and he suffered a brain injury. And because of that, he lost his job. He couldn't work with the injury. And also, in that time span, our house had burned down through no fault of my parents. It was just a technical problem. And so in this very short period of time, my father lost his job. He lost his home. He lost everything. And that really exacerbated the hoarding in the new home. He just sort of lost control. He became very, very reclusive. And it was the things that comforted him and helped him find his way back, in a sense.
And where would he get all these things? I mean, where would he find things?
Anywhere.
Just side of the road?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, we would go into a bookstore and pick up the free newspapers on the side, or yard sales, or, Kmart. I mean, it was just anything, anywhere things were available.
You have a description, I guess, later on where it sounded like this house was just, you could hardly move mm-hmm. in the house, and your mother sort of sleeping on an edge of a mattress, your dad sleeping on an edge of a mattress as well. I mean, it sounded like there was almost no room to move in the house without stepping on something.
Right. No, there was no floor. There was no space left mm-hmm. by the time that we left that house, and my parents just abandoned it at a certain point and started over.
And as a kid, I mean, as you said, you didn't hear the word hoarder until you were in high school, mm-hmm. really a senior in high school. But clearly you knew something wasn't right.
Yeah. I first of all, just felt like there was no one else in the world who would possibly live like this. I couldn't even imagine that this was a mental illness, that there were more like me out there who were living like this. But I also knew that whatever it was that was driving my father to collect things was so far beyond him that he wasn't doing it to hurt me or my mother. And when I was 9, he admitted himself to a mental hospital to mm-hmm. try and find a way to stop it. And at that point, there was no hoarding. No one was talking about it. There was no treatment. I mean, there's still very little treatment for it. And so he was just given a prescription for Prozac and sent home. So, he knew something was wrong, and we knew something was wrong, but we didn't have a name for it, and we didn't know how to fix it.
You describe, I guess, early on having a friend that does come over, and your father, he gets really angry. I mean, he really loses his temper, as if perhaps he'd been invaded or something was really troubling him.
Right. Well, this was immediately after his brain injury and the house had burned down, and so we were brand new in our new home. And a radio had broken, and my father sort of obsessively listens to NPR.
I had to chuckle when I read that.
It's his connection. He loves the news. He absorbs so much, and I think he just had some sort of break. He came from a truly abusive environment himself, and I think when he lost control, he returned to the childhood he knew.
And there seems to be a pattern for people who are hoarders. It's some degree of loss or trauma, and it sounds like your dad had a pretty tough childhood,
say
the least.
I am certainly not a mental health professional, and I've certainly did a lot of research when I was doing the book, but it's not my research, and I don't take ownership of it. But there are several theories on hoarding, and one of them is that children who were severely neglected at certain points in their emotional development start forming attachments to things, but also children who come from abusive backgrounds and mm-hmm. children of alcoholics, like my father.
And both his parents were alcoholics.
Both of his parents
violent
were violent
alcoholics.
Yes. And there was hoarding in his family, which is something I didn't know when I was writing the book. I've only recently learned through my father's family that hoarding had gone on for generations in his family.
And it also sounded like your mom, her mother sort of loved her second after another child. It seems like your mom didn't feel loved by her mom.
Right, no. And my mother certainly had a contentious relationship with her own parents. Mm-hmm. And she was very much neglected as a child. And so, we find the people who will love us anyway. And I think my parents were both these sort of abandoned souls, and they found each other. And, despite all of the flaws, they are each other's support system.
What's so interesting, as I said, I always was interested in the children of hoarders, is how, in certain ways, how clever they are. You mm-hmm. were. For instance, you picked another house in the neighborhood so that if you were picked up or dropped off, it wasn't in front of your house.
Right.
It was in front of a stranger's house. It looked better, I guess.
Yeah, it was a very nondescript house. I would never pick anything too grand.
Too lavish.
Yeah. Just small and normal and cleanly manicured, yeah.
So were you ashamed of your parents, or you were worried for them? I mean, in terms of keeping, as you say, that you had two different families, the kind of inside family inside the house,
yeah.
and then the outside family.
I don't think I was ashamed of my parents. I was ashamed of where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I separated my parents very early on from what my father collected and the illness. I don't think very many people can do that. Maybe some do. I don't know. But I was always able to separate my parents from what they were doing. And I wasn't ashamed of who they were, but I was certainly ashamed of how we lived and where mm-hmm. we came from. And I definitely internalized that shame. And myself started to think I was someone to hide.
In fact, you described yourself as being a shy child.
I was. I was barely audible in school.
But you had someone else mm-hmm. speak for you, right?
Yeah, the school had assigned another girl to be my voice in class because I was so quiet and I was so unable to speak above a whisper that I just had this other student who was my voice.
Wow. And why do you think you were so shy? I mean, does it have something to do with your father's hoarding? Or
I mean, it's very possible that I would have been shy had I grown up in a clean home, but I suppose a big part of it was this feeling that I didn't want to ever be noticed, because attention comes with notice.
Right. But you had some friends in school.
I did. I'm very lucky. I have a very, very close group of friends since childhood, and people who, over the years, figured out how I lived. I never had to tell them, and when things got to an unfathomable level of squalor, they would let me sleep at their houses on weeknights in the mm-hmm. winter when I didn't have heat, and let me shower at their houses when I didn't have access to a shower at home. And over the years, since my parents have gotten out of that particular house, they've helped me clean their new homes over and over to make sure that they never return to that mm-hmm. sort of level.
We're almost up on a break here, but your friends knew without you telling them?
Yeah, they figured something out. I'm not sure they necessarily knew the level of squalor I lived in, but they knew something was wrong, mm-hmm. and they knew I needed help, and they never asked any questions,
and they knew,
I was blessed.
And they knew because of just how you were looking or acting, or
I think I've always been I haven't necessarily asked for help, so when I did ask for things, they knew I was serious.
Well, we're talking with Kimberly Ray Miller in this hour of Radio Times about her memoir. It's a brand new book. It's called Coming Clean, and it's about being the child of a hoarder growing up in the New York area. And the book is about her father and her mother, the life they led, the kind of inside and outside family that they were, and how she, frankly, helped them come to terms with some of their issues and what she learned about herself as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents the Richard Thompson Electric Trio, Todd Rundgren, the David Bromberg Quintet, the Mavericks, Asleep at the Wheel, the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 15th through 18th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
I'm Jesse Thorne. The writer Fran Lebowitz basically doesn't feel stage fright.
I have no anxiety about it at all. I have actually fallen asleep in the Letterman green room.
She's pretty much fearless, except for in one important area.
I have only one fear, and that is of writing.
The writer Fran Lebowitz on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, unemployment in the Eurozone has fallen for the first time in more than 2 years. We'll take the temperature in Germany, Europe's economic powerhouse, and in Spain, where 1 in 4 is still out of a job. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kimberly Rae Miller. She's a writer and an actress and author of a new memoir called Coming Clean, and it's about growing up the child of a hoarder. Her dad was a hoarder, her mom a compulsive shopper. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It's interesting you got interested in acting. First of all, as a shy child, I know that's not necessarily unusual, but what do you think it was as a kid that so intrigued you about acting?
Well, I started acting because my mother was so concerned about how shy I was that she put me in acting lessons solely so that I would be able to speak aloud. And I sort of fell in love with it, and it became my coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. As a teenager, I would sort of invent these characters to get me through situations. And so I became the person I wanted to be through acting.
On the stage,
mm-hmm.
being these very and having a voice yourself,
right? Well, and also in real life, I would just take I would create these characters and I would live them, and it was my survival mechanism.
Were you shy at home, or were you shy outside in the world outside your house?
I wasn't shy at home. I mean, my family is despite the hoarding, my family's incredibly close and funny and smart, and they're just wonderful people and very accepting. And, we were loud and laughed a lot and had really, really in-depth conversations. And my parents were very focused on my education. And so at home, I was never shy. It was just outside in the real world that I had a really hard time.
You found out at one point that there was actually a stranger who had been living in the house. And you had some sense of this because you'd heard voices.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the house is so filled with stuff. The person could get in there and then be there without being found out.
Mm-hmm. There were stairs to our attic from our garage, and over the years the garage had sort of, the lock had broken and you could get in and out without a key. And so someone found out and they climbed the stairs to our attic and lived there for years. I mean, I had heard voices in the attic while I was still in high school. And when my parents abandoned the home the year between my freshman and mm-hmm. sophomore year of college, the place that bought it, and they bought it as is under the guise that they would have to clean it out themselves, reported back to my parents that in the attic they had found a man's clothing, a cot, hundreds of beer cans, and someone had been living there.
You write when you learned that you were actually correct, that there was someone living in your attic. You said, "I didn't feel justified. I felt violated. Violated because you knew something that everyone else had denied?"
Yeah. I mean, it was just sort of a further proof that there was something wrong with us, that it was, and there's a natural sense of violation if you've ever been robbed. I mean, someone else being in your home feels like a violation, but then having someone else live in your home with you is even more deeply scarring.
Well, and I would also think, I mean, as a kid, you thought someone was up there, but your parents didn't.
No. I think they just assumed that what I'd heard was like the scurrying of rats, and there's a certain amount of denial you need to live in those conditions. And so,
yeah, help us understand that denial, because, I mean, you didn't deny it.
I didn't. But my father, I mean, I have to say, my father just didn't see it. At the time, he just really thought that everyone lived like that. And that is part of the pathology of hoarding. And my mother was so depressed at this point that she just locked herself in her bedroom and didn't leave to see the rest of the house as it fell apart. And so, she needed to deny it because I don't think she would have survived it otherwise.
And it seemed like there was a lot of conflict between your parents about the stuff in the house?
Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, my mother was always afraid. I mean, I think she's still afraid to this day that one day I'll just hate her. That I'll wake up one morning and just decide that I had enough, it was too bad, I don't love her anymore. And, of course, that's never going to happen. I love my parents unconditionally, and that's really the point of the book, is what unconditional love really means. And, it's hard for her. I mean, I think there's a lot of impetus that mothers should be perfect, that they should protect their children at all costs. And my mother was dealing with such demons of her own that she couldn't protect me. And she looks back on it now, and she's just riddled with guilt.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, she had serious medical issues she had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, serious surgeries.
Yes. Yeah. So my mother has severe scoliosis to a crippling level, and she'd undergone spine surgeries when I was 9 to try and correct some of it. And they were unsuccessful, but what they did succeed in doing was sort of destroying her abdominal muscles and most of the muscles in her back, so she had to heal and let those muscles repair themselves. But while that happened, she lost her job and she was bedridden and needed, you know, my father and I to do everything for her. And while she was in bed, you know, the house just sort of filled while my father had no one to keep him in check.
Your book is To Mom and Dad, I Love You Bigger Than the World.
Yeah.
Let me just underscore what you say. But as a child, I mean, I think all children feel this. They love their parents and there are things their parents do that really anger them and frustrate them. So there must have been that part of growing up as well.
Yeah, you know, I honestly don't think I felt angry until I left. I think when you're living in it, it's your normal. You know, you are raised in it and you may know something is wrong, but you're just trying to survive. And there's no room for anger when you're just trying to get through the day.
Yeah.
And so it was dealing with it later when anger came into play.
But did you feel like as a kid growing up that you had to kind of take care of your parents or protect them somehow?
Absolutely. You know, I was always very hyper aware of people judging my parents. I've always wanted to protect them and make sure that people only saw the good in them. And there is a lot of good in them. And so all of my stories about my parents were about the amazing people they are. I never complained about anything. I didn't want anyone to see any negative in them.
But when you went off to college, which you did, you went to Emerson College, things changed.
Yeah, the hard part came when I came back from school between my freshman and sophomore year, and seeing it again with fresh eyes, having not lived in it, was such a shock for me, and it was so hard for me to start seeing that as my home again after being away from it for so long. And that summer, I also happened to lose my scholarship and was faced with the reality that I wouldn't be able to return to a pricey private school and would probably have to enroll somewhere local and live at home. And that was the breaking point when I overdosed on painkillers because I just couldn't imagine living that way again. And that really was the impetus for my parents abandoning their home. And, you know, at that point, they started over. They got an apartment and they've always struggled with this stuff, but over the years it's gotten less and less. I've certainly had to clean their home out numerous times, but they never have returned to that level of squalor.
But did they see your attempted suicide as a call for help or as a message to them that I can't live like this?
I think for them they were just so afraid of losing me that they would do anything.
Right. And were you serious about it?
I was serious about it. I mean,
you just felt like you could not live this way?
Yeah. I mean, the idea of returning home was too much for me to handle. But I still say it's the stupidest, best thing I've ever done.
Really?
Because I think that house would have killed my parents.
Just because it was in such terrible condition.
Yeah.
And them being there, especially with your mother's medical issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a sort of a call for help.
Yeah. I mean, I was helping them in my own overdramatic way.
Mm. Let me reintroduce you, and that's Kimberly Rae Miller, our guest today on Radio Time. She's written a book. It's her first book, and it's a memoir called Coming Clean, and it's about being the child of a hoarder. Her dad hoarded lots of stuff, was a big listener to NPR, I should add. Her mom, a compulsive shopper, and it's about growing up with them and coming to terms with their problems and her understanding of her own life as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, our guest is a writer and an actress. You sought therapy.
I did. When I first started, it was part of the impetus in writing this book, actually. In my mid-20s, I started waking up with nightmares and scratching compulsively, and it was the images of these fleas from my childhood, and I thought I had bed bugs, but it turns out I was just
hallucinating or just sort of...
I was manifesting this stress from my childhood, and so my best friend is a social worker, and she was like, you obviously are suffering from some sort of PTSD, and you need help. And I went to a therapist, and as I told her my life story in 45 minutes, I thought, there's no way she's going to believe me. This doesn't even sound real as I spew it out.
But she said, I don't think you're depressed, at least not chemically. I don't think you need medication. I think you've been through a lot and you need to find peace with it.
Yeah.
And the finding the peace with it seemed to be something that you resonated with.
Right. And that was the long journey. And that was a big part of why I wrote the book, was to just process all of it in a from a new perspective as an adult, looking at, you know, how I lived and the fact that I am entitled to anger. But I'm also, it's perfectly normal for me to still love my family, and, and that's okay too.
So feeling entitled to anger, that was a new thing for you?
Yeah.
To feel angry?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I've never been particularly comfortable with anger, and I think that's a big part of how I portrayed myself as this perfectly happy teenager for, you know, my entire adolescence, and it just became ingrained in me.
A good actress, yes?
I suppose so.
Yeah. So... have you, did you lose your temper with your parents? Have you gotten, I mean, do they know about that anger?
Absolutely. And, I mean, there was a breaking point, and I do write about it in their last move. They moved 2 years ago to a new home that they own, and they have been able to keep it clean. But before that, I had to clean out their last apartment and move them, pack them and move them and bring them to their new house. And while I was cleaning under some furniture, I'd found hundreds of pill bugs, you know, some alive, some dead. And that was really a breaking point for me because, you know, the bugs and rodents of my childhood really just came flooding back to me. And I told them, I'm done with you. Like, if you ever do this to me again, I can no longer be a part of your life. And they took it to heart, and they have kept their new home clean. I mean, it takes a lot of work. It'll never be easy for them. They have professional help coming in, and it's a full-time job for them to start try to keep these impulses under control.
But you meant that. If don't ever do this to me again, and if you do, that's it. Yeah. I'm over. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
You meant that.
At the moment, I did. I mean, they're doing so much better now. Yeah. I'm so grateful. But, yeah, absolutely.
I read an article, and it showed a picture of your apartment. You live in Manhattan.
I do.
And I didn't realize people in Manhattan live in tiny little apartments, and
do.
You have to keep them very neat. But it was described as, you know, just clean as a whistle.
It is. I do a lot of cleaning, and so does my boyfriend. I'm very lucky that he is a neat fellow. But we also have a cleaning woman who comes once a week.
Oh,
just because for my peace of mind, just to know someone is scrubbing everything is really important for me.
But do you, because there are genetic and familial components to hoarding.
Absolutely.
Have you ever felt you had that impulse that there were things you wanted to hold on to, or could live with a certain amount of mess or even trash?
Well, you know, I mean, I have nostalgia like anyone else. I mean, I keep, like, cards people send me in a box, and, you know, I have memories. I keep pictures. I'm not such a neat freak that I don't have anything. But, no, I don't like having clutter, and it definitely adds to my anxiety, and there's a place for everything. And, you know, it's important to me, but I wouldn't necessarily say that I have, you know, OCD on the opposite spectrum now.
Right, as a sort of compensation
right.
for your parents. And how are your parents doing? Then we'll get to some of our
right.
callers.
They're, you know, I'm very proud of them. They've really raised their own bar, and it's, like I said, it's a struggle for them, and it'll never be easy, but they work really hard at keeping this new place livable, and they've been able to have company. We've had Thanksgivings there, which we've never been able to do before, and you know, my mother is you know, vying for a grandchild, and she knows that I would never bring a child to their house the way it had been. And so it's really important that they keep it clean. And you know, I mean, and at this point, and they're older and they're more financially secure, and they can afford to have someone come in regularly.
And do you trust it? I mean, or is there a part of you that still worries that they might revert to?
Absolutely. I mean, I think throughout my childhood, I was always so optimistic that every new house was going to be the one that they kept clean, and that definitely died in me. And so, ironically, this is the one that they have been able to keep clean so far. You know, but there is a part of me that worries and thinks that I will always have to worry about it.
Let me see what looks like Don from the Northeast has to say. Don, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. You know, Kimberly, I think we grew up in the same house. It's funny, we probably just couldn't see each other. I have exactly the same situation. All of my parents are probably a lot older than yours. My mom's a compulsive shopper. My father is a hoarder. And I can't get them to get rid of their stuff, even though they will talk about it, and even though, you know, they know that it's kind of, crazy, but I'm wondering how you got your parents to actually give their stuff up.
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Well, I think, you know, they had to be ready to do it, and I think writing the book definitely helped. If you want to write a book about your parents, it'll definitely add some stress to the situation for them. But, no, they had to be ready for it, and for them, it was really the idea of losing me that forced them to, and I certainly wouldn't recommend saying I'm out of your life if you don't clean up. People need to be in a point where they can do that, and you know, it's always a battle, and the fact is that I do clean their house regularly. I get rid of their stuff, and that's the hard part, and it's not necessarily a permanent solution, but it's just maintenance at this point.
And Don, I'm just curious about your parents. Has this been an issue between the three of you?
Only in as much as I think that, well, for instance, my father has a boat in the garage that you really can't see because there's so much stuff piled up around it. He'd love to go out on his boat, so I've offered to help him get his boat out. But understand, you know, he feels the magnitude of task and constantly avoids it. It's certainly not a negative thing between us.
Right.
But I do tease them all the time that when they're gone, I'm going to put a cash register on the front step and just let people walk in and out of their house and pay whatever they want for whatever they get.
And do they?
Because my parents are not what you would consider dirty hoarders or trash hoarders. They keep clean things and things they want to collect. But it's stacked in rooms and Tupperware containers and racks of clothing and with tags on it still.
Yeah.
And it's like a store in there.
Yeah.
It's like a combination between a clothing store and a sporting goods store.
Well, Don,
and collectibles.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and sometimes even a talk to a therapist or someone who can just maybe give you some things to think about if it's obviously concerning you. But I do appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Kimberly, you know, what I sense from his call, and I'm wondering about your parents as well, just being overwhelmed by the stuff that you have amassed, collected, hung on to over the years.
Absolutely. I think it's different for my mom and for my dad because my dad doesn't see it. You know, he sees value in everything and he's not overwhelmed by it at all. For my mother, it's absolutely overwhelming because she does see it, because right. She does realize there's something wrong with the way they're living. And so for her, it sometimes becomes so overwhelming she becomes catatonic because it's just too much, which is where I usually step in.
Right. Step in as a cleaner or just a helper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Don, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Getting a very personal story about hoarding, being the child of a hoarder. And again, Kimberly Ray Miller is our guest today on Radio Times. She's an actress and a writer, and this is a memoir. Her first book is called Coming Clean. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Any questions or comments, do give us a call. We'll be right back.
Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are proud of our international sophistication.
I love British accents.
Here we go.
No, really, I do. I was in England one time for a couple of days, and they kept them up the entire time I was there.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the quiz that's funny in any language. Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR. Saturdays at 4 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Matthew McConaughey. His latest film, Mud, comes out on DVD next week. He recently starred in Magic Mike, Killer Joe, and Bernie, and co-stars in Martin Scorsese's next film. He'll talk with us about his life and movies and tell us why he often does this. Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Starlet, Celebrity Vortex actress Lindsay Lohan. Would you like to work with her?
Because of her public difficulties, it's hard for her to work because she can't get insured.
Director Paul Schrader on his new movie, The Canyons, the joys and perils of a movie that got made despite, well, you'll find out. Next time, it's Freaky Friday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Kimberly Ray Miller. She's the child of a hoarder. Her dad was a hoarder, possibly is a hoarder, but was a hoarder. Her mother, a compulsive shopper, and the houses that she grew up in were pretty much trash-strewn messes. She became adept at pretending that things were fine, but it came at a price. She wrote her new memoir, Coming Clean, because she says she wants to humanize hoarders and to offer a child's perspective. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm curious about in this, when the therapist told you you had to find peace in your life, and it sounded like you were trying to just fix everything all the time. Did you feel the need to forgive your parents? Was that part of finding that peace?
I didn't feel like there was anything to forgive. You know, I didn't say you did this to me, and so you need to apologize, and I need to forgive you. It was what it was. It was our lives, and you know, my parents struggled as well, and you know, it certainly affected their mental health knowing that they were putting me through this as well. It wasn't something they did on purpose to me. They just did it despite their best intentions. And so I never felt like I had to forgive them, but I did have to come to terms with the fact that I did have feelings about it.
Right. And I guess, and accept the feelings and accept where they came
from. Right. And learn that I can't take care of my parents for them. I mean, I still struggle with that, and I'm never going to abandon them and say, you're on your own, kid. I have to take care of myself. But, you know, to say that I can't change who they are.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have to live close to them?
Well, I live 2 hours from them, which is enough space. Yeah. But I do get to see them relatively regularly. So I see them about once a month, and that's a good ratio.
And when you enter, is it an apartment?
They live in a condo now, actually.
In a condo. But when you go in there, is the first thing you sort of look around to see if there's stuff?
I scan. But because their house is currently a lot cleaner, I also don't feel as much animosity as for helping out. Like, if they need help with stuff, I don't feel angry about it. I feel like, okay, they need a little help, and that's fine. So
let me get back to our callers. We've got, looks like Maureen from Doylestown joining us on Radio Times. Maureen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Kimberly. Hi, I have a question for you. I'm in real estate, and I was in a person's house who was a hoarder. And, you know, you see that, and it's overwhelming. But my question to you is, did you ever have an outsider come in to see that, like someone, just an outsider, for whatever reason, come into your home and see that, or, you know, see how you were living? And, you know, because I always wondered, like, geez, do you make a call to someone? Mm. I mean, this is, you know, what do you do when you, as an outsider, if you see that?
Maureen, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Kimberly.
Well, in the house that I left when my parents left when I was in college, no one ever saw the inside, ever. You know, we were lucky that we didn't have a mortgage. We paid cash for the house because we'd had a settlement from our house burning down earlier. And so there was no need for it. And we didn't sell it through a real estate broker. We ended up selling it to a construction firm that just basically demolished it and used the land. Mm. So no one ever saw it. And so, I mean, people certainly had inklings. We used to get letters in the mail from neighbors telling us how disgusting and horrible we were and that we didn't deserve to be on the block and whatnot. Yeah.
But if you needed a plumber or a repairman, you didn't call them. They didn't come in the house.
No, and that's why our heating and pipes broke, because they were too ruled by embarrassment to let anyone in to fix things.
In fact, you describe, I think you were in kindergarten at the time, and you told a teacher or principal that you had a sister who your dad put in the trunk. This turned out to be a doll.
Yes.
But they sent a social worker over to see what was going on in this house. And you saw your parents scurrying around and cleaning up the house. You were what, five years old?
Yeah, I think I was four. I started kindergarten early. But yeah, so my parents basically took off work for a week and cleaned the house from morning to night, and fighting was rampant, and By the time the social worker came a few days later, the house was still messy, but normal-ish messy. And so, you know, he didn't remove me from the home, but my parents were certainly afraid that I'd be taken away from them.
And when you saw your parents doing this, I mean, you were a little girl then. Did you know what they were doing?
Well, my mom explained it to me after, you know, and that was when I really knew that something was wrong with us. You know, I knew that our house was messy, but I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. You know, other people lived in clean houses. Mm. We were all just were different. But when my mom told me, you know, daddy's messier than other daddies and we can't tell anyone about him. Mm. That's when I knew.
Right. But going to other people, kids' houses, I mean, you must have seen how dramatically different their houses were.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't so much upsetting as it was freeing to go to somebody else's house.
You could use their shower, perhaps?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I showered at a lot of friends' houses.
Yeah. And when we talk about, I don't know, I'm not trying to embarrass you here, but, you know, talking about, I mean, you grew up in houses that were infested with fleas and rats.
Yeah. I mean, you know, fleas are sort of a normal part of suburbs, but because of all the stuff, we couldn't use bug bombs to kill them. They would just hide under the papers. And so there was no way to get rid of them.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Dr. Verdarmi. I got the name wrong here. Calling us from... anyway, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks for the great show.
You're welcome.
Dr. Lori Verderame.
Okay, Verderame. Sorry about that.
You can call me Dr. Lori, as most people do. I was calling because some of your folks probably know me from the Discovery Channel. I'm an art and antiques appraiser. I walk into homes all over the country that Kimberly is describing. And what really struck me, and I listen to your show all the time, but I must confess I never call in, what struck me about Kimberly and her book was this. I see Americans collecting all of this stuff. There's somebody who says it's valuable.
Hmm.
And this starts a whole domino effect of problems. Some of it's valuable. Some of it's junk. And you're speaking to a PhD antiques appraiser now. So, I mean, some of it we have to say it's junk. But my point in calling was that when you said, what about a counselor? What about a social worker? What about an expert appraiser? What about someone who's an outsider? With respect to the family's trying, but all of the emotions and all of the quote-unquote baggage comes in. Sometimes a stranger can do what the family just can't.
Well,
and that's my only point, because I work with these families and mediate and help these families all day, every day in my job.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Anything you want to add to that, Kimberly?
Well, absolutely. I think that the more we know about hoarding, the more people there that are going to be trained in the mental health field to deal with it. And that's only a good thing. You know, I mean, I really hope that all the research that's being done now will help us find a way to effectively treat hoarders. I don't think as of yet there's really been a successful way of treating. I know behavioral therapy tends to be more successful than cognitive therapy. But there's no method yet. And I think that's still to come, but it's hopeful. It's hopeful because we're spending so much time in the media discussing it.
Yeah, indeed. And your dad, I guess, has sought therapy to some degree of success? Or
he has. And, you know, the problem is that there aren't a lot of people who specialize. And so we're just constantly searching for the right fit for him. And also a lot of people who do work in this field don't accept insurance. And, you know, normal working class Americans can't necessarily afford to spend $200 every week to talk about their feelings.
Indeed. Does he talk about it? I mean, I'm the fact that you've written this book, has that helped your dad or encouraged your dad somehow to talk more about himself?
Yeah, my dad is just, he's such a private person. And you know, similar to how I say that I put my childhood away, you know, in a lot of ways, my father blocked out his entire childhood. He doesn't have memories. And so that, I think that's a testament to how bad his childhood actually was. But the older he's gotten, the more hoarding has become a part of the popular zeitgeist, the more he identifies with it. I actually bought him a copy of Stuff by Professors Randy Frost and Gail Steckety, and he read it cover to cover, and he sees himself in it, and he's more aware of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it goes in and out. I think I sort of liken hoarding to binge eating, where you know afterward that you did it, but in the moment, you can't stop yourself.
Well, I'm certainly no expert, but having just occasionally watched some of these shows, I mean, you know, we call it junk, but to the hoarder, for whatever reason, that comb that's under all that stuff has value and meaning for them. That's what's so confounding, I
yeah.
think.
Well, you know, there's this amazing moment with my dad when I was a little girl, and I think it sort of speaks to what hoarders see in things, which is when I wouldn't eat breakfast unless I could watch Sesame Street. So my dad went out to the garage and he brought in a bunch of broken mirrors and he positioned them between the living room and our kitchen against furniture and stuff. And it was almost like a pinball machine, the way the reflection came through to the kitchen so that I could watch Sesame Street while I was eating breakfast. And my dad is sort of magic in that way because yeah. he sees this potential in things. And so that's a moment where, you know, it came to fruition what he sees in these broken mirrors.
Well, and not only could you watch Sesame Street, but you could watch yourself watching Sesame Street
yes.
with all these mirrors, just to add to
yeah,
the,
it was an amazing
the,
moment.
The
and I think that
ingenuity
was,
of what he set up.
Yeah, that was sort of when I knew that my dad was brilliant in his own way.
Let me see what Marie from South Philadelphia has to say. Marie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My comment was that I do have a friend who is a hoarder, and we've discussed this, and she said that she finds a sense of security with all of the stuff around her. It's almost comforting, almost as if she's created a womb-like atmosphere, and that's one of the reasons that prohibits her from getting rid of a lot of this stuff.
Does that make sense?
And I was just wondering what
sure.
Kimberly's father, if he had those feelings. Of course, you know, she hasn't discussed his childhood, but I think that has a lot mm-hmm. to do with it, too. It's, you know, they need the comfort of this insulation that's protecting them from the outside.
Well, Maria, I appreciate the call, and we touched on your dad. There's much you don't know about your dad's childhood,
right.
but you know a little bit.
Yeah, but absolutely. That's actually one of the most common things people who struggle with hoarding say, that they're building this world around themselves of all of the things that comfort them. It's almost a form of perfectionism, of creating a little perfect world for themselves. And I think in that way, I think that's a way that we can all sort of relate to what they're going through. Absolutely.
Thanks for the call. Let me see what Bruce from Perkasie has to say. Bruce, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
great show as always.
Thank you.
Raised by a father who was quite the hoarder. I have tremendous memories of going down the basement and having such a teeter-totter series of piles of his stuff down there. You know, if I'm getting a I'm 52 years old now, I'm getting a tool when I'm 12, and if I rotate, you know, 45 degrees instead of 40 degrees, there'd be this amazing crash, you know, the volume of which was only exceeded by my father yelling at me then for knocking over his stuff.
Wow.
And my comment is that it informs us as adults, you know. I will never, ever have a garage that I can't park two cars in, you know. And now I run a karate school in Upper Bucks County, and I have a Japanese sensibility. And if surfaces aren't clean and clear and flat, I don't, you know, I feel the stress. And I will share with you quickly one thing that helped me was that doctor that called earlier and
yes.
said bringing in a stranger. Hoarders are frequently very, very frugal. And the concept of paying someone to come in and analyze their personal stuff is like an alien conversation. And I got to tell you, the only requirement is that it's someone who doesn't own your stuff. It can be your best friend. And for them to pick it up and say, where does this go, Bruce? It's huge. You know, it's huge. And it helps me with my simple piles that I create today to this day. So wonderful show. Thank you
Thank you, Bruce.
For sharing all
Well, you're very welcome. And thank you for sharing your stories as well. Kimberly, I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Absolutely. Well, I think a lot of the children of hoarders sort of find solace in clean spaces. Absolutely. But when my parents moved, I, for their homecoming present, I bought them a day with the personal organizer to come in and put their stuff away with them so they would find a method for it. And
that hold up?
It was, well, actually, it was sort of a disaster. This, my mother is very, very small. She's like 4'9", and the woman who came in was sort of an Amazon. And so she kept putting my mother's stuff in places she would never be able to reach it. So my best of intentions, but it didn't
yeah.
work out quite that well. But I did see the anxiety in my parents when someone came in and started to tell them what they needed and what they didn't. And you know, in a way, I started to become very protective of them because I sort of felt like, you know, they're trying really hard.
Right.
let's not make them feel worse. So,
but that sounds like it's almost your job. I mean, that you're the one that knows them best,
yeah,
and understands their quirks,
mm-hmm,
and
absolutely,
and how to help them feel better, and you know what upsets them.
Right, and I can tough love them, and they won't feel too invaded, whereas a stranger would definitely make them become very, very isolated and insular.
So do you have regrets about your childhood?
I don't. I think my childhood made me who I am. And, you know, I think that I am who I am because of my parents, not in spite of them. And, you know, I'm grateful that I have them as parents. And regardless of the way we lived, I always felt loved and mm-hmm. I always felt wanted and, you know, protected in my own way. And so, yeah, I wouldn't change anything.
And just the kind of resourcefulness that you have, and I've seen with other children of hoarders, I mean, it's quite something. And also a kind of intelligence, a kind of insight about perhaps the adult world.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, I think, you know, like I said before, I think children of hoarders certainly grow up a little quicker. I think it's the same with children of alcoholics or addicts. You know, you grow up protecting the people who are supposed to be protecting you. And in that, you sort of see the humanity in people that maybe others wouldn't.
Do you think it made you a good actress?
I think so. Certainly helped my career.
Well, Kimberly Ray Miller, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, and congratulations on your book as well.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Coming Clean. And again, our guest, Kimberly Ray Miller, it's a memoir. It's her first book. She's a writer and an actress, lives in New York. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.